British Public Radio. Nature.
This week, how video games do you good?
They are effects that are positive on how well you see, how well you pay attention, different aspects of cognition.
And how many omes can you name?
Genome.
Phenome.
Interactome.
Metabolome.
Transcriptome.
Proteome.
Who wins the ohm off and which ohms really matter? Find out in just a moment.
Plus, using psychology to decide which animals to conserve in zoos. I'm Charlotte Stoddart.
And I'm Sia Cunningham. Once upon a time, there was the genome. The term was coined in 1920 to describe all the genetic material of an organism. Back then, it was one of very few scientific words ending in ome. Fast forward nearly a century and there are thousands. Some omes raise an eyebrow, like museomics, a term for sequencing objects stored in museums. But adding this little syllable to the end of a word can help to highlight an exciting new area in science. In a feature this week, Nature reporter Monya Baker chooses five up-and-coming omes. Kerry Smith swung by the San Francisco office to see Monya and to talk about three of them.
What I thought it might be quite fun to do, to start with, is to have a little ome off, because there are so many of these things. So I'll go first and we'll just see who runs out first. Are you ready?
All right.
Genome.
Phenome.
Oh God, you're really quick. Interactome.
Metabolome.
Transcriptome.
Proteome.
There must be loads more.
3,000.
3,000? And I've got as far as three.
I think some of them have only been used by the people who coined the word.
Let's start with the phenome. What's a phenome?
So a phenome is a collection of all the physical and behavioral characteristics of an organism. And what people are trying to do now is really catalog all these characteristics in such a way that they can be easily related to variations in the genome. And if you think about the way DNA is, it was almost made for bioinformaticians. It's four letters, it's a one-dimensional text string. Physical and behavioral characteristics, completely not. We have a lot of different words to describe the same thing. Some people will say short stature. Some people will say height, less than one percentile. There's really no way for people who study human physiology to exchange information as easily as the people who study genetic sequences do.
So the phoneme is kind of an organizational exercise, is tidying up?
I think it's not quite tidying up, but it's definitely a challenge of people learning to talk to each other on agreeing on certain terms.
Okay, so moving on to ome number two here. This is the interactome.
So if you think about the big three, the genome, the transcriptome, the proteome, those are all really parts lists. But they don't make anything happen. Things happen when one molecule comes in contact, interacts with another molecule. And the interactome is a project, an effort to try to catalog all of those interactions. Most of it is looking at protein-protein interactions. And if you think about the scale of this, it's just ginormous. There's, say, 20,000 genes. And if you do the math of all the possible interactions, 20,000 human genes squared, divided by half, that's 200 million possibilities. Now, they don't all exist, they don't all happen, but figuring out which ones really do happen is a huge effort.
But that's going to be arguably, you know, this is the way forward. We've got a list, as you say, mm-hmm. of the genes, we've got half-finished list maybe of the transcripts, and then to figure out how they're all interacting is really how the game is played.
I think so, yes.
And the third one we were going to talk about was the integrome. Interactome, integrome, what's the difference here?
The integrome is an effort to integrate all of the different kinds of data and to make sense of it. And this is really where the future is, to understanding health and disease and evolution and the interactions with the environment. One analogy that I really like is that most omes give you a list of genes, a list of transcripts. And the integrome puts it together, and it's sort of like Google Maps. You might be able to get a list of gas stations, a list of streets, a list of restaurants. But if you can actually say that this gas station is two blocks from this restaurant at the intersection of these streets, you've really got some useful information if you're trying to get around a city.
And so the future of this, it seems to me, is, you know, we've got the parts lists, we've got the kind of restaurants, the street names, the gas stations. There's some attempts to merge them together into some kind of, you know, at least two-dimensional map. And now we would need to know, for example, whether the restaurant and the gas station move over time, whether the businesses change.
That's a wonderful analogy, yes. I think that where things are going is less from collecting all the lists, though that's still very, very important, but really figuring out, once you've got that information, how do you find what relationships are there, what relationships are real, and what relationships can help you understand how biology works, how disease works?
Okay. Well, Monia Baker, in the Nature San Francisco office on the intersection of Bush and, I think, Kearney, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Monia Baker talking to Kerry.
Coming up in the research highlights, how bees use electrical signals to find flowers and 3D holograms that can move. But first, video games like Call of Duty and Halo have a bad rep. They're often linked to violent behaviour, but the evidence is far from clear. So what is the current boom in virtual entertainment really doing to our mental health? In a comment piece this week, Daphne Bevelier, a neuroscientist from the University of Geneva in Switzerland, describes some surprising findings. Noah Baker put down his PS3 and picked up the phone.
There's been a lot in the press and so on about how damaging and negative video games can be, but you're suggesting that there might be positive effects, is that right?
Yes, so we have done research looking at the positive effects of video games, and we are actually at very interesting times because this research and that of other labs are showing that there are effects that are positive on how well you see, how well you pay attention, different aspects of cognition. So clearly video gameplay has an impact on brain and behavior. And what's really striking is that some of the most impactful games, for example, when it came to enhanced vision, are actually initially were not designed for impact, they were designed for just entertainment. So we're really talking here about entertainment video games, not packages that were designed for improving your vision.
There are many reports of video games leading to increased aggression and so on. Would these kinds of effects potentially outweigh the benefits from playing them?
What is very clear is that just after being exposed to a violent video games for 15 minutes, you're going to be more violent for the next 15 to 30 minutes. What is much less clear is whether these translate to actually long-term effects. The games that we have been using in our research are indeed violent. Just happens that there is no video games on the market that has the right kind of game dynamics we're looking for and is not violent, but it's not difficult to create, it's just that it doesn't exist. So we actually have a grant from the National Science Foundation to test whether an action game without the violent component would have the same kind of effects on what we have documented before.
There has been studies done, there was actually one published in Nature recently about the effects of games such as brain training, and they actually found they didn't do anything in particular to enhance your cognition. I was wondering what your view of that would be.
There are some really counterintuitive findings where some of the games that like are initially developed for impact don't have that much impact, and some games that are actually developed for just entertainment seem to have quite a large impact. Video games come in many different versions. You know, it's not the same thing to play a role strategy game than to play a first-person shooter game than to play a mini game about working memory. These are very, very different experiences with different recruitments of brain networks and different demands on your cognitive system. And that's exactly what we're working on, is trying to know which ingredients in the video games that know to have an impact are present, so that we can then tell people that want to design games for education or games for clinical rehabilitation, here are the key ingredients to trigger the kind of impact you're looking for.
You've mentioned things like visual acuity and attention. Are there any sort of more psychological or emotional benefits? Could you promote cooperation or anything along those lines using video games?
So this is really where the next phase of research lies. There is a few research from other labs showing that you can actually promote pro-social and empathic behavior through video games. So if you ask people to play video games where they have to help the character, then they're more likely to help in real life just after they have played the game. We don't know how long-lasting these effects are. We don't know whether they can really change social conduct for the long term, and that's where we need much more research.
My final question, actually, is you really are interested in trying to get these benefits into mainstream games. You don't want to create educational games. You want to create entertainment games, which also train your brain. Is that right?
That would be fantastic. We are at a turning point right now where there is really a willingness from the entertainment industry to bring together those communities, neuroscientists and game designer from the entertainment industry. So this is really encouraging, but one of the big challenges that is laying ahead is that these are fields that typically don't talk to each other, so we actually use different language, and we really need to establish common ground and be able to understand each other's field to begin to work together. And so there is much need for interdisciplinary team to be put together and also the funding necessary for supporting this interdisciplinary effort.
Daphne Bevelier talking to Noah Baker.
Now it's time for the research highlights with Adam Rutherford.
Along with colour and scent, electrical fields on flowers can guide bee search for pollen and nectar. Flowers often have a negative charge, whereas insects such as bumblebees build up a positive charge as they fly. Scientists at the University of Bristol in the UK have shown that bumblebees change a flower's electrical potential for a short time after they visit. The bees can sense these electrical cues and use them to remember which flowers provided them with a reward. The study is published in Science. Holograms can display images in 3D with no need for special glasses, but these images are usually static. Now researchers have made a hologram that moves. The team at Tokyo University of Science use liquid crystals made of chiral compounds. The crystals change the way they bend light if you apply an electric field. The researchers use two coupled laser beams to make a hologram that refreshes an image every 8 milliseconds, fast enough to produce a smooth holographic movie. The idea could be used to make 3D displays. Find that study in the journal Applied Physics Letters.
Jeff Brumfield will be joining us shortly with the news, but first, before Kerry flew to San Francisco, she sat down with conservation psychologist John Fraser, one of many speakers at the AAAS meeting in Boston.
A few days ago, the San Francisco Zoo announced a new arrival. Leanne the Sumatran tiger gave birth to a cub, and newspapers around the world went crazy, as you might expect, because there are fewer than 500 of these tigers in the wild, and the cubs are really cute. The birth illustrates a bigger question, though. How do we decide which species to prioritise for conservation and for zoos? And is this just as much about human emotion as it is about animals? I'm with John Fraser, who's an environmental scientist and psychologist. He's from the New Knowledge Organisation in New York. Hi, John.
Hi, nice to meet you.
How do conservationists decide which animals to conserve? What factors matter in choosing your priorities?
Well, in the last 20 or 30 years or so, most conservation organizations have been working on biodiversity in terms of a community, a region. There has been some talk about the concept of umbrella species and the idea that there are alpha animals like predators at the top of a chain or a food web who are important for regulating animals that are in that area. These tend to be chosen based on location or region. There has been very little concerted effort, though, to focus globally on how we think about what animals we should be working on in terms of biological distinctiveness and our future as a planet.
And when you say biological distinctiveness, you're still speaking as an ecologist and an environmental scientist here, right? Because distinctive animals for your average 10-year-old on a family trip to the zoo are the megafauna, the charismatic, you know, polar bears or penguins.
When we think about zoos, we often think that they should align their collections directly to conservation programs that are happening in the wild, and that's not really the way I think about the role zoos play in conservation. When we look at prioritizing species we should have in zoos, I think we need to use a different metric. We need to be thinking much more strategically about how those animals can help us grow as a culture and work on conservation issues.
As I mentioned in the introduction, these tigers that have just been born, Knut the baby polar bear from Germany, we remember him fondly. These all inspire emotion in visitors to zoos and presumably even in conservationists, right? How much does emotion have to do with this?
I don't think we can ignore how important emotion is in conservation. For people who are working in the field in conservation biology, you get to know your study species and you become very attached to that species. I think often people put that same lens, though, on zoos. And when we talk about things like the polar bear in Germany or the tiger in San Francisco, we're really looking at a different vector. The role of those animals to evoke an emotional connection is only a stepping stone to what is possible with zoos, because people do want to become emotionally invested and engaged with other animals. That's why charismatic megafauna are interesting. But to me, I consider this like speed dating. It's the start of a conservation conversation with a guest to an aquarium or a zoo, but it's not where it ends. And we've had a lot of focus recently on the use of these animals as if the first hello is the start and that's where it should stop. I suggest that we need a lot more science from my field. I think my field, psychology, has let down the zoo and the conservation movement by not really digging into the emotions of attachment, how attending to animals and discovering the variety of life on Earth can be influenced by encounters with real animals living their lives, getting to know those animals. And from that, you develop a much deeper understanding that helps you understand why they're threatened.
How do you leverage, then, that empathy and that emotion provoked in someone who sees a really cute baby panda and make them care about endangered beetles?
Well, it's not a direct line. What we find is that these experiences are reinforced over time, and from that we come to start to care for more animals and systems. But we have to start with that first visit, the hello, the speed dating, but then build it into a relationship that is meaningful and deep.
Is this a new idea to base zoos around kind of human psychology?
It's not a new idea to use psychology, but we have very little research on the psychological impact of specific animals, on types of experience and how those experiences work, the role of contact, the role of observation, the right mix of large charismatic megafauna, and quite frankly, the use of the exhibits for other purposes such as capacity building for skills development for people who are going to work in field conservation, for new people into the field learning behavioral observation techniques, for using the animals as models to do long-term research on the life cycle that will influence how we understand what's happening in the field with endangered species.
Using psychology as an input to kind of how to create a zoo and get people emotionally engaged with it, how does that go down when you talk to pure conservationists?
I think conservationists are coming around. I will say that there are many conservationists who don't like seeing animals in zoos because they don't face the same natural pressures. They don't see that same life spirit. But at the same time, conservationists we know really want to see the education outputs of how it's working. So when I talk to them about the kind of psychological studies that we're doing and the impact we can have on causing cultural change, usually I get a lot of support that this is a useful tool and they just want to see the data.
Kerry again there, this time talking to John Fraser.
Okay, joining us in the studio now for the very last time is Jeff Brumfield. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Charlotte.
Now, last week we had a story about sham stem cell treatments. This week we've got a stem cell trial.
That's right, and it's the very first stem cell trial in humans. Masayo Takahashi, who's a researcher at the Riken Center for Developmental Biology in Kobe, Japan, is about to try a new use of induced pluripotent stem cells, iPS cells, to cure macular degeneration, which is one of the most common causes of blindness in older people.
So why has he picked that particular disease for the very first iPS cell trial?
So there are a couple of reasons why they decided to approach macular degeneration. One is that they know how to turn the iPS cells into the types of cells they need. Stem cells are, of course, famous because you can make them into any sort of cell you want. And they know how to turn these cells into the proper cells to replace the ones that are dying off when you have macular degeneration. Another reason is that they're a little bit worried about maybe cancer forming as a result of putting these cells in the eye or some other complication. And the eye is an organ that's very easy to reach, very easy to operate on. And so if there were complications, they could presumably deal with them.
What's the likelihood of this working?
Well, that's a really good question, and I think it's quite an open one. In fact, some U.S. researchers that are quoted in this story think that maybe they've moved a little too quickly in Japan. Japan's regulatory framework is very different from the U.S. or Europe, and it's a little bit murkier, to be frank. And it has allowed this particular trial to go quite quickly to the stage of testing on humans. Several U.S. researchers in the piece feel that this has happened too quickly. There's no guarantee that it's going to work, and that maybe there should be more tests to make sure, for example, that cancer doesn't form or there isn't some other complication. But the only way we're going to know is when the study is complete.
Okay, we'll keep following that story. Now to an area of medicine that's very well established, the use of statins. What's going on there?
Yes. So statins, of course, are used to treat cholesterol, and you said it's an area of medicine that's very well established. But it's maybe not quite as well established as we thought, because as it turns out, there's a new push by researchers to take a hard look at these cholesterol targets that are set. You know, everyone's told what is their healthy level of cholesterol, and when they're over that, they're given often statins to lower cholesterol. But there's a growing concern in the research community that, in fact, that's not the best way to do it.
That sounds worrying, because an awful lot of people take statins, don't they?
They do. And in fact, one of the researchers in the story, a guy named Joseph Francis, who works at the Veterans Health Administration in Washington, D.C., was put on statins and started to have a lot of fairly rare but kind of serious side effects, muscle pain and discomfort. But as he fiddled around with his statins dose, his cholesterol level wasn't really responding very well. And it got him to thinking that maybe this was not actually the best sort of indicator of whether using statins was the right thing to do or not. So he and other researchers have been looking at this, and sure enough, they find that there's no real proof that the target lowers your risk of heart disease or anything else.
So what now?
Well, that's really the question, isn't it? So, I mean, for the moment, the targets stand. But a panel of 15 cardiologists are drawing up new guidelines, which should be out later this year, and may actually drop the targets. This doesn't mean, by the way, that statins don't work. But what it does mean is that this fixation on keeping cholesterol at a certain level, it may not be the best way to use statins, that there may be sort of different guidelines that can be put in place. For example, prescribing statins in someone to lower their risk of heart disease rather than to get their cholesterol to a fixed point.
Finally, then, we've got an announcement on open access. Tell us about that.
So the U.S., which is the largest player in published scientific research globally, has finally revealed its open access policy. And this is a broad agency policy that goes across all the different scientific agencies in the U.S. government. And it says that all papers will have to be free within the first year of publication.
How does this compare with policies in Europe or Asia, for example?
I can't really speak to Asia, but in Europe, the UK has taken a lead on open access, and they've announced a policy, what they call a gold policy, which means everything has to be free from the point of publication. That's set to go into place on April 1st. Now, initially, at least, it's going to be using a small pot of money from the research councils to pay the costs. Of course, we should say the way open access works, if people don't know, is that the agency includes funding for publication in the grant, and then that money goes to the publishers to produce the paper and put it through peer review and all that. And so the argument with government is that, you know, since government's funding the research, it's public money, it should be publicly available.
And what's the reaction been to the US policy announcement?
The reaction has been disappointment, largely. This 12-month delay is what the publishing industry obviously lobbied for. And it allows the publishers to continue to sell subscriptions to libraries and make money through their old models. Now, interestingly enough, Nature, in the same issue, has an editorial speaking out in favor of the gold model. So Nature is actually stepping forward here and saying that they don't want this 12-month policy. They want things to be available from point of publication.
That's what the editorial says. But right now, Nature isn't publishing all research open access, is it?
No, that's right. We are not an open access publication as of this moment. And I think, you know, what this shows is that we would like to move in that direction and we would like to see the publishing industry move in that direction. So I think what this editorial says, if I understand it right, is that we are committed to open access and we're very interested in it. And we're disappointed in the U.S. policy because we feel that they could have done more. They could have made a bolder move in that direction the way the U.K. is trying to do.
Interesting times in science publishing. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you very much, Charlotte.
Join us again next week when we'll be looking at women in science. I'm Thea Cunningham.
And I'm Charlotte Stoddart. Thanks to Mike Koenig and Well from soundbible.com for their sound effects.